You are seeing your last patient of the day in your obstetrics clinic. Gina Gilbert is a 21-year-old, otherwise healthy woman who you are seeing for her first pregnancy. She and her partner Jeffrey are at the visit. They are recently married and had not been planning a pregnancy yet, but are excited to become parents even so. The pregnancy has been going well, though they only began seeing you at around 10 to 12 weeks gestation, since they were not expecting a pregnancy so soon. Gina is now 18 weeks gestation, and you are to perform an ultrasound at this visit. You observe a fetus with features consistent with an 18-week gestation, but are concerned by a spinal defect in the lower lumbar vertebrae. You note it has a small sac with neural elements outside of the spine, just below a thin skin and subcutaneous tissue layer. As you consider these findings, you wonder, what are the possible causes for these findings? And were there any interventions that could have prevented it? Consider your answers as we begin this next episode. Welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Adam Weinstein, bringing neurology from our bricks to your ears. Let's get started demonstrating how kids are not little adults. After completing this episode, you'll be able to 1. Compare and contrast the anatomic and clinical features of the neural tube defects, including those of the spine and the skull. 2. Describe the mechanism that leads to 4 brain abnormalities. 3. Discuss the anatomic and clinical features and treatment of congenital hydrocephalus. 4. Describe the defects of the cerebellum and brainstem. And 5. Describe the defects of the spinal cord and discuss the anatomic and clinical features of syringomyelia. Part 1. What are the congenital disorders of the central nervous system? The central nervous system, or CNS, which comprises the brain and the spinal cord, is an incredibly complex part of the human body, so it is no surprise that sometimes things go awry during its development. The various anatomic anomalies that result can be so severe as to be incompatible with life, such as when most or all of the brain fails to develop, a condition known as anencephaly. CNS abnormalities are among the leading causes of infant mortality and fetal loss. These anomalies can involve the brain, spinal cord, and/or meningeal development and position. Although the brain and spinal cord each arise from the neural tube, their development differs. The end result is that the spinal cord is fairly uniform in structure throughout its length, but the brain subdivides into different regions, each with its own structure and function. Accordingly, congenital anomalies of the spinal cord are similar anywhere along its length, whereas congenital anomalies of the brain are different in different brain regions. We'll organize this episode by discussing CNS congenital anomalies in terms of, first, those that can involve both the brain and spinal cord, for example, neural tube defects. Second, those that involve the cranial parts of the brain, for example, forebrain anomalies. Third, those that involve the caudal parts of the brain, posterior fossa anomalies. And lastly, those that involve the spinal cord. Let's begin. Part 2, etiologies of congenital anomalies. Broadly speaking, there are genetic and non-genetic causes of congenital anomalies. Genetic causes are intrinsic to the fetus and include chromosomal disorders as well as single gene mutations that can be passed down in an autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive, X-linked, or mitochondrial manner. Non-genetic factors, for example, teratogens, can cause errors in morphogenesis, leading to congenital anomalies of the CNS. These factors include, but are not limited to, maternal illnesses like pre-existing diabetes, multiple gestations, drugs and chemicals such as alcohol, cocaine, lithium, and oral isotretinoin, and infections, including what we refer to as TORCHES infections. TORCHES, standing for TO, toxoplasmosis, R, rubella, C, cytomegalovirus, HE for herpes infections like HSV, and also H for HIV, and the final S for syphilis. Lastly, genetic and non-genetic factors may also work in combination and interact to result in congenital malformations. Part 3, neural tube defects. With that introduction, Let's now discuss CNS congenital anomalies that may involve both the brain and the spinal cord. These are the neural tube defects. Neural tube defects are a spectrum of congenital anomalies occurring anywhere in the dorsal midline of the body. They range from mild to severe. Despite their name, the feature that is shared by all neural tube defects is abnormal formation of the bone dorsal to the neural tube, which would be the skull and the vertebral arches. Defects in the neural tube closure are present only in the most severe abnormalities. This sounds quite a bit like the findings in the Gibson's prenatal ultrasound. Specifically, I think there was a defect in the lumbar vertebrae and neural elements in a small sac outside of the spinal cord. I wonder if their baby could have a neural tube defect disorder. Neural tube defects are multifactorial in origin. Risk factors include maternal diabetes and obesity, inadequate folate intake, and certain medications, including valproic acid and carbamazepine. Neural tube defects can be identified through prenatal screening. An elevated alpha-fetoprotein in amniotic fluid and maternal blood can be concerning for the possibility of a neural tube defect, as would elevated amniotic fluid acetylcholinesterase levels. Prenatal imaging, as we did for the Gibsons, would be definitive. Neural tube defects can be prevented through a number of measures, including avoiding or discontinuing medications or drugs associated with these disorders, maintaining optimal glucose control for patients with diabetes, and through folic acid supplementation. Folate occurs naturally in many foods such as beef, eggs, green vegetables, and avocados, and many other foods such as bread, flour, and cereal have been fortified with folate. Women who are planning to get pregnant are encouraged to eat folate-rich foods and take a daily folic acid supplement both prior to conception and during pregnancy. Before moving on, let's test our knowledge with a question for review. What is the underlying cause of neural tube defects? Neural tube defects are primarily due to defects in bone, specifically the skull and vertebrae that lie dorsal to the neural tube derivatives. Part 4. What are the different types of neural tube defects? Neural tube defects may involve any portion of the skull and vertebral column, though the lumbar sacral level is the most common. They generally are divided into those that involve the vertebrae, called spina bifida, and those that involve the skull. Bifida in Latin means split or open, so this literally means an open or split spine. Spina bifida is subdivided into spina bifida occulta, which literally means a hidden split spine, and spina bifida cystica, which is having a protruding cyst, and there are three types of cystica. In each of the four types of spina bifida, the dorsal vertebral arch is incomplete. From least to most severe, the types are as follows: spina bifida occulta, and then the three types of spina bifida cystica: first, meningocele; second, myelomeningocele; and lastly, myeloschisis. Spina bifida occulta and myelomeningocele are the most common of the four types. Spina bifida occulta is the most common, and also the mildest form of neural tube defect. It consists of a cleft or defect in one or more of the vertebral arches, but the spinal cord and meninges are normal, and they do not protrude outside the spine. In this case, even though there is a defect in the vertebra, there is nothing abnormal about the actual nervous system, so patients are often asymptomatic and without neurologic deficits. A clue for spina bifida occulta may be a tuft or hair or a dimple in the skin over the involved vertebra, but otherwise there may be no other evidence for it. A meningocele is the next type of spina bifida we'll discuss. A meningocele, meaning a sac of meninges, occurs when the meninges herniate through the vertebral defect, but the spinal cord does not herniate. Therefore, the spinal cord and nerves are positioned normally. Meningoceles are the least common form of spina bifida. It's the next level of severity after spina bifida occulta, and because the spinal cord and nerves are reasonably normal, only mild neurologic symptoms, if any, such as impaired bladder control, are present. With the next level of severity, let's discuss the myelomeningocele. The second most common neural tube defect, Myelomeningocele literally means a sac containing meninges and spinal cord. Therefore, this occurs when both the meninges and spinal cord herniate through the defect in the involved vertebral arches. Thinking back on the Gibson's ultrasound, there was a defect in the lumbar vertebrae and some neural tissue in a sac outside the spine. This sounds awfully like a myelomeningocele to me. With myelomeningoceles, the overlying skin is generally very thin or missing, and so this may make patients more susceptible to infection. The herniated spinal cord and attached spinal nerves are malformed and result in significant neurologic deficits at the level and distal to the spinal defect. These often include loss of both sensory and motor function below the level of the involved spinal cord and difficulty with autonomic control of the anal and urethral sphincters. Myelomeningoceles are also strongly associated with Chiari type 2 anomalies of the brain, which we'll discuss further later in the episode. Before we move on to the final and most severe form of neural tube defect of the spine, let's take a question break. What are the anatomic differences between spina bifida occulta and myelomeningocele? Well, both are conditions due to a defect in the spinal vertebral arches, but in spina bifida occulta, there is no herniation of meninges or spinal cord outside the spine, whereas both the meninges and the spinal cord herniate through the defect in myelomeningocele. The last and most severe form of spina bifida, called myeloschisis, occurs when the neural tube fails to close in some region of the dorsal midline. Myeloschisis literally means a split spinal cord. The lesion consists of exposed neural tissue with no covering, not even covered by meninges. Fortunately, this doesn't sound like the Gibson's ultrasound, since we saw a thin layer of skin and subcutaneous tissue overlying the abnormality. Phew. Part 5. What congenital anomalies arise from defects of the skull? Thus far, we've been emphasizing our discussion of neural tube defects on spina bifida, which involves defects of the spine. Encephalocele and anencephaly are two neural tube defects involving the skull. Let's discuss the less severe form, encephalocele, first. Encephalocele, meaning sac-containing brain, is much like myelomeningocele in that the underlying nervous system herniates through a bony defect in the skull. In the case of encephalocele, the bone with the defect is usually the occipital bone, and the herniated tissues are the brain and meninges. Encephaloceles are the least common type of neural tube defect of the brain. Anencephaly is the most severe neural tube defect. It literally means no brain, but the term is also used to describe an infant born with a partial brain, and not necessarily a complete absence of brain. Anencephaly is analogous to the most severe type of spina bifida, myeloschisis. Anencephaly occurs when the neural tube at the level of the brain, the cranial neuropore, does not close. Consequently, the forebrain fails to develop, and there is also lack of development of the overlying skull, which is why the brain, or what exists of it, is exposed. There is some variability as to how much of the brainstem forms, and of note, this defect does not affect facial development, so these infants typically have a reasonably normal-appearing face below the eyes, but they have an absent forehead due to the absence of the skull. Of note, anencephaly is accompanied by polyhydramnios in utero because the fetus does not have neural structures to enable swallowing. Anencephaly is not compatible with postnatal life, and most infants live no longer than a few days to a week. Before moving to the next part, let's consider a question. What are the anatomic differences between encephaloceles and anencephaly? In encephaloceles, the brain and meninges herniate through a defect in the skull, usually the occipital bone, but the neural tissue is covered by skin or meninges, whereas anencephaly occurs when the neural tube, specifically the cranial neuropore, does not close, so the forebrain and skull fail to develop, leaving neural tissue exposed and uncovered. Part 6. What congenital anomalies result from forebrain defects? Moving on from neural tube defects, let's now discuss defects in the brain, specifically the forebrain. You may recall that normally the forebrain, also called the prosencephalon, develops into the telencephalon and diencephalon. These form the cerebral hemispheres and the thalamic structures respectively. Forebrain anomalies, therefore, include congenital anomalies of the cerebral hemispheres, thalamus, and hypothalamus. They generally result from errors in the generation and migration of neurons. These neurons come from a pool of proliferating precursor cells next to the ventricles, called the germinal matrix. Let's review this with a quick question. Which parts of the brain do forebrain anomalies involve? Forebrain anomalies can involve the cerebral hemispheres, thalamus, and hypothalamus. One of the major presenting findings of forebrain anomalies may be microcephaly, or an abnormally small head size. Microcephaly is the first disorder of the forebrain that we'll discuss. Primary care providers routinely measure and plot head circumference at health maintenance visits in children up through 3 years of age as a screen for early intervention. Microcephaly occurs when too few neurons, for whatever reason, and there are many different reasons, reach the cerebral cortex, resulting in a smaller brain volume and head size. Fetal alcohol syndrome is an important etiology of microcephaly and is the most common etiology of congenital cognitive disability in the United States. Two other disorders of the forebrain describe abnormalities of the gyri. Lissencephaly means smooth brain and is a disorder related to there being too few gyri. This occurs when neuronal migration stops prematurely. Children with this condition have variable degrees of developmental delays, cognitive impairment, and seizure disorders, depending on the severity and degree of malformation. Polymicrogyria is another disorder and refers to an increased number of gyri, but gyri that are overly small, and it occurs when meningeal tissue is trapped at fusion points in the cortical gray matter. Many small, irregular gyri form on the cortical surface, leading to an abnormally thick cortex. Polymicrogyria is often part of a syndrome or one of a number of developmental abnormalities. Children with this condition typically have developmental delay and cognitive impairment to varying degrees, as well as other neurologic dysfunction, such as motor, swallow, and respiratory dysfunction and seizure disorders. The final disorder of the forebrain that we'll discuss involves abnormalities in the separation of the forebrain into two hemispheres. These disorders are collectively called holoprosencephaly, meaning one prosencephalon, or one forebrain. Holoprosencephaly is a spectrum of median brain anomalies arising when the telencephalon only partially divides or fails to completely divide into two hemispheres, and also two ventricles, two basal ganglia, and so on. It is often accompanied by anomalies of median or orofacial structures, such as closely set eyes and midline cleft lip or palate. Severe forms include a single hemispheric ventricle, as well as severe anomalies of facial structures, including cyclopia, literally one eye like a cyclops, and a proboscis, an abnormal nasal structure due to midline abnormalities. Severe forms of holoprosencephaly are fatal. Now time for a question. In holoprosencephaly, what embryonic part of the brain does not subdivide correctly in the midline? The telencephalon does not divide normally in the midline in holoprosencephaly. Part 7. What congenital anomalies are associated with cerebral spinal fluid imbalance? Before we discuss the congenital disorders of the caudal parts of the brain, let's consider congenital anomalies associated with cerebral spinal fluid, or CSF excess, also known as hydrocephalus. The most common cause of congenital hydrocephalus is stenosis of the cerebral aqueduct, which is the conduit that helps CSF flow from the brain to the spinal cord, and specifically connecting the third ventricle to the fourth ventricle. It is located dorsal to the pons and just ventral to the cerebellum in the midbrain. Aqueductal stenosis could be congenital, but other causes that disrupt the flow of CSF from the brain to the spinal cord could also include intraventricular hemorrhages, as commonly occurs in extremely premature neonates, the congenital torches infections, spina bifida, and a number of genetic conditions. Presenting symptoms of congenital hydrocephalus may be irritability, somnolence, decreased appetite, and vomiting. On physical exam, the infant will have a larger than normal head, also known as macrocephaly as opposed to microcephaly, a bulging anterior fontanelle and widened suture lines. Early treatment is important to optimize neurologic functional prognosis, especially development and cognitive function. If the cause of the stenosis or impairment of flow is not directly fixable, then typically a shunt will be placed surgically, which provides another path for the excess CSF to drain into another body space, most often the peritoneal cavity, in which case the shunt is called a ventriculoperitoneal shunt, or VP shunt. And now for a question. What is the most common cause of congenital hydrocephalus? Obstruction of aqueductal flow is the most common cause of congenital hydrocephalus. Part 8. What congenital anomalies result from cerebellum and brainstem defects? Moving on to the caudal parts of the brain, the cerebellum and brainstem are located in the posterior cranial fossa, so congenital anomalies of the cerebellum and brainstem are sometimes categorized as posterior fossa malformations. Recall that this fossa is in the posteriormost region in the skull. Its walls are the occipital and sphenoid bones, its roof is the tentorium cerebelli, and the large hole in its floor is the foramen magnum, the site of the junction of spinal cord and brainstem. Posterior fossa malformations all involve the cerebellum, and they may or may not involve the brainstem. Let's discuss them from least to most severe. First, let's discuss two malformations called Chiari malformations. The two types of Chiari malformations share one important feature: herniation of the cerebellar tonsils downward through the foramen magnum. Recall that the cerebellar tonsils are a pair of caudally located bulges next to the midline, lying next to the foramen magnum. Therefore, malformations that displace the cerebellum downward may lead to downward herniation of the cerebellar tonsils through the foramen magnum. In the first type of Chiari malformation, conveniently called a Chiari type 1 malformation, the cerebellar tonsils, and nothing else, herniate caudally through the foramen magnum. This is typically a fairly benign malformation and often goes asymptomatic in childhood. It may be discovered later in adulthood when patients can present with headaches associated with coughing or straining. Sometimes patients present with symptoms attributed to cerebellar dysfunction like ataxia and downbeat nystagmus. Lastly, Chiari type 1 malformations may be associated with syringomyelia, which is an abnormal spinal cord cavity. Syringomyelia is a congenital disorder of the spinal cord, which we will discuss later in this episode. In the Chiari type 2 malformation, also called the Arnold-Chiari malformation, both the cerebellar tonsils and vermis, the midline region of the cerebellum, herniate caudally through the foramen magnum. This occurs because of a small posterior fossa with too little space for all of the fossa contents. This can lead to stenosis within the spinal tract at the level of the aqueduct in the midbrain due to traction on the aqueduct from the downward cerebellar herniation. This can then cause hydrocephalus. Lastly, there is also a structural change in the posterior midbrain described as beaking, which reflects displacement of the midbrain colliculi posteriorly and into the cerebellum, and clinically may correlate with severity of nystagmus. Chiari type 2 malformations also occur in association with lumbosacral myelomeningocele, which is a condition we spoke about already in the context of neural tube defects. That's the abnormality we were concerned about on the Gibson's ultrasound, wasn't it? We probably ought to explore the baby's brain imaging more carefully to confirm or rule out a Chiari type 2 malformation, right? Before moving on to the next congenital abnormality of the posterior fossa, let's break for a review question. What are the cerebellar anatomic anomalies in a Chiari type 2 malformation, and how do they differ from a type 1 malformation? In Chiari type 2 malformations, the cerebellar tonsils and vermis herniate through the foramen magnum, whereas in type 1 malformations, it's only the tonsils. The next condition we will discuss is called the Dandy-Walker syndrome. This syndrome is characterized by an enlarged posterior fossa, agenesis of the cerebellar vermis, and consequent cystic enlargement of the fourth ventricle. Without the vermis, the fourth ventricle is roofless and expands to fill the space, creating a large cyst where the cerebellum should be normally. Affected children present with hydrocephalus, causing macrocephaly, delayed development, and motor dysfunction. This syndrome may also be seen in association with spina bifida and agenesis of the corpus callosum. The last and most severe abnormality of the posterior fossa we'll discuss is Joubert syndrome. This syndrome is characterized by cerebellar vermis hypoplasia, with resulting elongation of the superior cerebellar peduncles extending between the cerebellum and the midbrain. The brainstem is also malformed and misshapen. Together, the abnormal cerebellar peduncles and brainstem appear on imaging as a molar tooth sign. Literally, on axial imaging of the midbrain, the elongated cerebellar peduncles extending towards the midbrain gives the midbrain an appearance that looks like a molar tooth, instead of like a butterfly, which would be its normal appearing shape. Part 9. What congenital anomalies result from spinal cord defects? The final set of congenital disorders we will talk about relate to abnormalities of the spinal cord. These disorders include hydromyelia and syringomyelia. However, we'll just consider syringomyelia in detail. But briefly, hydromyelia occurs when the ependymal cell line central canal of the spinal cord expands, allowing CSF to accumulate. This buildup of pressure on the spinal cord can damage neurons and axonal connections. Unlike hydromyelia, which is a cavity that forms secondarily due to pressure, syringomyelia is a primary structural defect and cystic cavity, or syrinx, in the spinal cord. Of note, if it extends into the brainstem, it is called syringobulbia. Syringomyelia can occur at any spinal cord level, but it happens most frequently in the cervical region. The cyst puts pressure on the surrounding spinal cord, particularly the neighboring thin anterior white commissure, which connects the left and right sides of the spinal cord. The spinothalamic tract is located here, and the pressure results in a bilateral loss of pain and temperature sensation in the arms at the spinal cord level of the syrinx, whereas fine touch is typically preserved. Are you still with me? Here's a question break. What sensations are lost in syringomyelia at the level of the syrinx? Syringomyelia causes loss of pain and temperature sensation, spinothalamic tract, at the level of the syrinx. If the syrinx expands, it can damage the anterior horns and cause segmental lower motor neuron signs, for example, flaccid paralysis of the hands if located at a cervical level. Syringomyelia may be acquired and develop after trauma or tumors. Congenitally, it is strongly associated with the Chiari type 1 malformation, as we discussed earlier. And that's all I have today for congenital disorders of the central nervous system. So let's see if we've completed our goals for this episode. Can you compare and contrast the anatomic features of the neural tube defects of the spine? Neural tube defects are characterized by dorsal midline defects, or openings, in the skull or vertebrae. Vertebral defects lead to spina bifida occulta, meningocele, myelomeningocele, and myoschisis, and these vary based on whether the meninges and neural tissue herniate through the defect and whether they are exposed or not. Can you compare and contrast the anatomic features of the neural tube defects of the skull? Skull defects include encephalocele and anencephaly, and these vary based on whether the herniated brain is exposed versus covered by meninges plus or minus skin. Next, can you describe the mechanism of forebrain abnormalities? If the cerebral hemispheres, thalamus or hypothalamus, form abnormally, a forebrain anomaly results. Forebrain anomalies occur because of improper generation and migration of neurons from the progenitor cell pool in the germinal matrix. Can you discuss the anatomic and clinical features of congenital hydrocephalus? Congenital hydrocephalus is an excess of CSF resulting from impaired flow of CSF from the brain to the spinal cord. Children may present with irritability, lack of interest in feeding, vomiting, and somnolence. Can you describe some defects of the cerebellum and brainstem? Chiari malformations involve downward herniation of parts of the cerebellum and may involve the brainstem too. Dandy-Walker malformations and Joubert syndrome result from congenital defects of the cerebellar vermis. And lastly, can you discuss the anatomic and clinical features of syringomyelia? Cystic spinal cord enlargements, like syringomyelia, can impinge on neighboring axonal tracts and may result in bilateral segmental loss of pain and temperature sensation. Armed with your newfound knowledge of the congenital disorders of the central nervous system, let's revisit our patient's story from the beginning of this episode. If you recall, you are seeing the Gibsons for a prenatal ultrasound at 18 weeks gestation. You observe a fetus with features consistent with an 18-week gestation, but are concerned by a spinal cord defect in the lower lumbar vertebrae. There's a small sac with neural elements outside of the spine, just below a thin skin and subcutaneous tissue layer. As you consider these findings, you wonder what are the possible causes for these findings, and were there any interventions that could have prevented it? You recognize the combination of findings are highly suggestive of a myelomeningocele, a type of spina bifida. You realize Gina is otherwise healthy and doesn't take any medications, so the only intervention that could have prevented it would have been folic acid supplementation beginning earlier in the pregnancy. As the Gibsons had not planned to have a pregnancy this soon after their marriage, they had not anticipated this need. Patients with myelomeningocele can be born with quite a number of neurologic symptoms and findings. You counsel the Gibsons about symptoms such as impaired bladder and bowel function, lower extremity sensory and motor impairment, and the possibility for an associated finding such as a Chiari type 2 malformation and or a Dandy-Walker syndrome. This is very scary for the Gibsons. You share that there are many specialized care teams who can evaluate and support their child and the family and work towards the best possible neurologic functional outcomes for their baby. We provide them with some patient educational reading materials and make prenatal referrals to a number of these specialists with expertise in myelomeningocele. You schedule a follow-up visit with them as well to ensure they have good understanding of their treatment options and have their questions answered. And that's all I have for today's audio break. Thanks for joining me. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up or a comment. You can enjoy the full Brick experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. Stay healthy out there.